Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the role of the U.S. military in achieving U.S. objectives in the Middle East? And how and when does that role extend beyond the application of military force? The United States Central Command oversees U.S. combatant activity throughout much of the Middle East, including Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. But its mission extends beyond its indirect oversight of fighting units to areas like economic development, weapons and narcotics trade, and support of local governments. So what are the greatest concerns for CENTCOM in 2009? And what do its commanders see as its most notable successes recently and shortcomings? Rear Admiral Michael T. Franken is here to talk about it. He is Deputy Director of Strategy, Plans, and Policy for United States Central Command, and he's in town today at the invitation of SMU. Admiral Franken, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's good to be here.
CENTCOM has identified instability in Pakistan and Afghanistan as the most urgent problem within its area of responsibility. How do on-the-ground conditions in those two countries interrelate?
Well, the borders in much of the Central Command region, and I'll use the term AOR, its area of responsibility, are rather arbitrary, having been constructed long before there was a good understanding of tribal relationships, and they stretch through ungoverned areas. So there's a linkage mostly through bloodlines, and if you're living in Western Pakistan, you're completely oblivious to going over a border into Afghanistan. So they're joined, and in history going back 3,000 years, I mean it just, and if you fly over in an airplane, it certainly isn't any geographic change. But the short of it is, when you look at Afghanistan, you cannot look for success in Afghanistan without addressing issues in Pakistan. Similarly, you can't address success in Pakistan without looking at Delhi in India. Similarly, Delhi begins in Beijing, and Beijing in the Central Asian states and Russia, and going around through Turkey and, of course, the Middle East peace plan. It is all interrelated.
Can you talk about for a minute why on-the-ground conditions in Afghanistan have so deteriorated in recent months?
Well, there's almost a step function correlation between the influx of U.S. troops and violence on the ground. Principally because we're putting troops in areas that we haven't been before, and we're staying in those areas. There is some corresponding increase in violent behavior by the occupants and by the foreign fighter flows into Afghanistan elsewhere. But we are attempting to put a Westphalian type of government into the rural areas that have not had that type of governance before. And there's a large reluctance, and there are a number of tribal reasons that are pushing back on that kind of governance.
Well, and I'm sure we'll talk here more about this new idea to continue increasing the number of troops that are there in Afghanistan. Defense Secretary Gates for a long time was concerned that increasing the amount of troops we had in Afghanistan would be perceived by the people there as more of an invasionary force than one in place to help. It seems, at least through media reports, that perception is changing. But can you talk about what you have to look at and what you have to consider before you think about perhaps recommending additional troops?
Well, General McChrystal has an initial assessment, which is in the notification stage, both in Europe and in the United States here in Washington. So it will detail his in situ assessment of what's needed. I would not like to fair lead that solution set, but all those things are certainly considered, and it's imperative that we look at not winning or losing Afghanistan, but we look at objectives. Afghanistan's a country that's been at civil war for 35 years. All of its infrastructure, its the mores that hold the society together are pretty much damaged, in some cases irreparably so. So you need to build from the bottom up. It's not going to be an easy slog in Afghanistan. And the president has verbalized his strategy, and it's under constant assessment. And I would expect in the next month or two, we will look at it through a more a slightly different aperture and come to a reassessment of our objectives. Over.
By the end of this year, the president's commitment of an additional 21,000 troops would bring us to about 68,000 in Afghanistan. If we look at an additional 45,000, which is the number that people have been floating, that would essentially more than double the number that we had. What can those additional human beings accomplish that the ones who were there previously simply weren't able to get done?
The principal objective that everyone, for the most part, agrees on is building the Afghan security forces so that there's a self-determination. They can develop the necessary security to bring in the tenets of good governance and society to build that nation from where it presently is, which is quite biblical, frankly. If you've flown over areas in Helmand Province in the south of Afghanistan, it's unbelievable. The level of poverty and development is staggering. So those extra troops would primarily be assist brigades to build the civ mil connection in Afghanistan.
Civilian military.
Correct.
Have you seen a great enthusiasm on the part of Afghanistan government and military authorities to build to the level that they need to be? Or are they, at this point, sort of content to let the U.S. continue taking a lead role?
Well, that question will receive answers that run the spectrum. Mm-hmm. I've not been to Afghanistan in a number of months, so... But I would like to say yes, and I'm highly hopeful. The people on the ground are perhaps best to ask.
Can this work with a national government in place in Afghanistan that many people believe is inherently corrupt?
The level of corruptness is a relative term in many areas of the world. President Karzai is a phenomenally talented man. He has a nation that is in a dire situation. You know, just in this morning's papers, you perhaps saw the statistic that 1 in 10 members of their armed forces is literate. And matter of fact, that could be a stretch in some areas. It's very difficult. So when you have individuals in government who have a level of education which is not very high. And matter of fact, you've got schools that advertise the fact that their level of education has not changed since the 14th century. It's difficult. So he's working hard, and he's been in office for a number of years to build those tenets, to build some structure. But this is a generational effort. This does not happen in 1 year, 2 year, or a single administration. And the biggest question is, does this nation, does the world community, does ISAF have the effort and the stamina to see it through?
I'm glad that you brought the literacy statistic up. Just as a military professional, can you talk about how you would even approach trying to train a modern fighting force and security force without the ability to pass out written documents and to sort of keep track of things on paper?
Well, first you have to train the trainer. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the trainer is illiterate as well.
Yeah.
So it is show and tell time. The other aspect is, if the person with whom you're speaking, his father wasn't literate, mother, grandfather, etc., no one in his family has ever been literate, it's difficult to impart upon them the worthwhileness of being literate. So you have to approach things differently. There are no easy answers, and there are certainly no easy solution sets. How you go about it, it's very manpower intensive. And there's also a very high, most of the conscripts come into work, or sign a contract that is a year long. They're about, and after that year, they go home. There's also a very high AWOL rate, absenteeism. So it's one step forward and half a step back with Afghanistan. So I mean, it takes an unbelievable effort. Now, the United States is a fabulously broad-shouldered nation, and if we have the will, we'll do it. But it's not going to be easy.
Afghanistan has been called famously the graveyard of empires. Is that overly dramatic, or having now worked in that arena, can you see why that was written?
I see why it was written, indeed. Now, it's if you are an outdoorsman, when you see Afghanistan, you'll say, "Oh my word, what a fabulous country!" But when it doesn't have the infrastructure, when it doesn't have the road and the rail network to get its products out to the market or to bring other products in, and it's an insular society, so one village in a river valley may not speak the same dialect as the next village a few kilometers away, and may be a different bloodline, may not even look the same, and may have warred with each other for 100 years. It's very difficult, and then there's a Hobbesian type of government here in that the state is not omnipotent in determination. It is the tribe. It is the local capo-like individual. It is the strong man. It is the family member who is the eldest male. And it's difficult to work against that because the sense of a government that you can't see having a set of laws that are not Quran-based is hard for them to understand.
My guest is Rear Admiral Michael T. Franken. He is Deputy Director of Strategy, Plans, and Policy for the United States Central Command. Infrastructure development or redevelopment is one of the areas in which the United States has been criticized, both domestically and in the international community, for sort of failing to have as much impact for the money that has been spent. Is there a place that CENTCOM would like to see those efforts focused when it comes to civilian aid and things that aren't directly under your control?
Well, development in a nation is the State Department's role principally. We've done a nice job, I think, in consolidating the whole of government, the comprehensive government approach in Central Command. We have 20 nations, from Kazakhstan in the north to Yemen in the south to Egypt in the west to Pakistan in the east. It's a fascinating area of the world, 512 million people, the home of the three primary monotheistic religions and four religions, and unknown number of offshoots. There is no simple solution in developing a civilian military structure which works in each country. It requires a comprehensive approach, State Department led. The military, due to the type of people we have in the military, our competence in planning and capacity in planning, were helpful in that respect. But this is led by the State Department. And I can list a number of examples in Central Asia and elsewhere where we're doing a nice job.
Let's do that right after our break. My guest this hour is Rear Admiral Michael T. Franken. He is Deputy Director of Strategy, Plans, and Policy for the U.S. Central Command. We'll be back in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Rear Admiral Michael T. Franken. He is Deputy Director of Strategy, Plans, and Policy for United States Central Command. If you'd like to join us this afternoon, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Admiral, before the break, you tantalizingly offered us some examples of places in which the State Department has, in fact, been successful in the past. Talk to us about that and what we might learn that could be applied in Afghanistan.
Well, we've got as I said earlier, we have a wonderfully broad-shouldered nation. We bring a lot to the equation. We really are leaders in developing the most from agriculture and from good governance and libraries, et cetera, overseas. And even language training. We spend a lot of money training military people to speak other languages. We also have developed a way to say, and we said, well, if it takes $100,000 to train a person to be fluent in, say, Arabic, why not employ a teacher in a public school and a number of public schools in country X who instruct English and under the United States dime funded? And it's not a lot of money. And yet 30 students per class, a number of classes per day. In the future, we're developing people that understand the language and consequently understand the English type of the internet and our sense of values. This is an investment in the future. There's a number of water projects. I mean, there are so many that I urge you to go to the State Department website for these various countries and read about what we've done for them. And oftentimes without a U.S. fingerprint, per se, on these efforts, but for the betterment of the citizenry.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the State Department. The budget of the State Department is something like 1/12 of the budget of the Department of Defense, and there are some obvious reasons for that. But in fact, General Petraeus has been quite vocal about saying it's not enough expenditure, given the state of the world and the things you have to deal with. Can you talk about what might change in terms of what CENTCOM is trying to accomplish in any given day if the State Department had greater funding and sort of took over some of the functions that right now are on the back of the military?
Well, you're absolutely right. And Chris, you're exceedingly well-versed in the topics du jour. The State Department is, most people really think that the State Department runs just political military affairs between the United States and overseas. Actually, they're intimately involved in building the infrastructure overseas and imparting a Western sense of values, which is helpful, and these nations want that. Should their budget be more? I'll leave that to the budgeteers. But it has been going up. Correspondingly, they need to be manned to the point that that they can spend this money wisely. And I urge young people out there that are looking for jobs to do and make a lifetime endeavor to look at government service. State Department overseas, it's a fabulous lifestyle. It is languages and cultures and living overseas with your family and kids going to DOD schools, which are exceptional in most nations. And do not only look to the military as a line of work if you want that sense of adventure, but also look for State Department and other branches of our government who have offices overseas. It's a great life.
How are men and women doing on the ground in Afghanistan right now?
Well, casualties have been up. It's last month was the bloodiest of any. We are quite settled in some locales, built up bases that we're operating out of. In other situations, it's rather stark. I was not long ago in southern Afghanistan visiting some Marines, and there were 63 people in this small base, this FOB. It was nothing but a burned area with dirt piled with some concertina wire on top. And they had a mortar pit set up, and there was one air-conditioned tent, which could seat about two people in a classified internet machine. People slept in tents with the flaps up on cots, usually fully clothed with their, and there was no running water, of course. It was all bottled water. They lived off MREs. They had had 300 and some fire missions out of their mortar pit in the 3 months that they were there. They had lost a number of soldiers, say, Marines. The dust that is everywhere, it was like talcum powder, 4 inches deep. And as you walked on it, it blossomed up. It was 117 degrees the day we were there. And they were unbelievably happy. They were doing what they were trained to do. But if people realized the sacrifices they were making and the conditions in which they were living, they would be amazed and very proud, frankly.
We're hearing now about the possibility of certain deployments to Afghanistan being extended by a matter of weeks or a matter of months in some cases. Realistically, from a human resources perspective, how long can you expect a professional soldier or Marine to live in those conditions and remain productive?
Well, I don't know. I'm a naval officer.
Or seaman.
I found the afternoon to be uplifting but also fatiguing.
But these are questions I know that you
sure,
consider.
Sure. The U.S. sends our soldiers over there for a year. Other services, other nations send their soldiers over there for as little as 4 months to 6 months. It's certainly more productive to send someone over there for a year in terms of the training and the and getting them geared up. And there's a level of competence as time goes on. So we've got a fabulously competent force. First of all, I for one, I've had 6 deployments in the Middle East in my career. But you have Army Rangers and Marine Corps people that have been 4 or 5 deployments. So I mean, they know the score. They're very very comfortable in what they're facing over there. The short of it is, it really makes you proud. And if you can develop a conversation with someone who's over there and keep them company via email, that's kind of a nice thing to do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Sam, who writes, "Why should we not let the Afghan political and economic situation take its natural course? For example, leave it alone and allow the Taliban to win. What is wrong with that?"
Well, you're not alone with that thought process. The Taliban, frankly, is kind of a misnomer. There isn't a single Taliban organization. There are some fundamentalists who base their existence on Sharia law, and they run the gamut, as you would expect in religion.
Not centrally organized.
Not centrally organized. Not by any stretch of the imagination. So there is, there are members in the Karzai government who we would consider them somewhat zealots in their religious undertakings, but they're really, I mean, it is what it is in Afghanistan. The problem with the Taliban and the well right of center Taliban would be that this is the same organization that let Al-Qaeda blossom, and the world cannot take another breeding ground for Al-Qaeda that they launch out from and conduct attacks like they did in 9/11 and before.
As goes Afghanistan, so goes Pakistan.
I wouldn't say that was necessary, but each has its different solution set. Pakistan, there's a higher sense of self-governance, and General Kiani, matter of fact, is visiting the United States now. He's head of the army. Pakistan has, for a long time, had an issue with ungoverned areas and some malign influences that emanate from that ungoverned area. They're attempting to fix that, to correct that. Now, some of that, some of those issues bleed over into Afghanistan. It is our job with the border coordination centers, which we're developing, to try and fence off each nation from each other so that their individual solution sets can be addressed. And that is the a rather large effort for General McChrystal.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Brett in Louisville. Hi, Brett.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for thank you for your service. I think we all appreciate it big time. You know, the first President Bush said that, you know, there was no way to the reason he didn't go to Baghdad was because there was no way to get out. I'm just wondering what the end game is in Afghanistan and if we're in kind of the same boat and what goals, you know, not only are the soldiers working towards, but are is the Afghan and additionally the Pakistani governments working towards?
Well, thank you for those words. First of all, for Afghanistan, you know, there's a stated presidential, the president's strategy. There's an ongoing assessment, and he's looking at it every day. As a matter of fact, I was called just as I'm coming in here about various aspects of it. General McChrystal has an initial assessment, which is in the process of being addressed in terms of whether it's in sync with the president's strategy and how the two combine to step out into perhaps a renewed strategy. The short of it is, we have to decide as a nation: do we want to give Afghanistan something they've never had before, and that is a sense of self-determination and the ability to make a life better for their children than their parents presently have. And that's kind of the short of it. Is it important? And then what does that life look like? Certainly it's not going to be a life like we have in Dallas, Texas, not any time in our lifetimes. But is it a standard of lifestyle that includes electricity and communication and an economic self-sufficiency, which they don't presently have? And if you look at the population of Afghanistan, the reproduction rate and the infant mortality rate, you'll see that they will double in population while most of us are still alive. They cannot feed themselves now. The chances of them increasing production in the out years in their present state with their present infrastructure, it's unexecutable. Something has to be done. And they're not, certainly Afghanistan's not alone. There are other nations in the world that are in that same situation. But we have, that is, you know, you cannot look at Afghanistan just from a security perspective. You have to look at its future self-determination and economic self-sufficiency. Our strategy is the whole gamut. And the question is, are we willing to undergo that major effort?
Well, you've already sort of touched on this, but we're currently awaiting this report on the 50 benchmarks that will assess the progress of the United States' involvement in Afghanistan. I recognize that some of them are classified, but are there other things that you didn't mention in your previous comments that might give us a sense of what your folks are looking for when deciding how to make decisions and how to really assess where we are?
There are my office is involved in this, so there the topics, the lines of operation followed by, you know, how you're grading at the metrics, they are very extensive. And certainly things like school attendance and kilowatt hours used and production of agricultural products, the cutback on the production of opium, all those things. I mean, the number of people that are hired for government service, and the amount of assistance that is being given by other nations, all those things are measured and stirred in a large pot until we kind of come up with a solution that says yay or nay, things are improving. It isn't easy, but it is stretches across all elements of government in Afghanistan.
I recognize that the situations in the two countries have been different from the outset, but is there anything we can learn from the success we're now finally seeing in Iraq and plans to gradually pull down our forces there? Is there anything we can learn to apply to Afghanistan, which seems to be more mired in problems than it has been in 8 years?
Yeah, I think the things that we've learned in it in Iraq are now second nature to us. First of all, we need to be much more culturally savvy. Granted, the culture in Iraq is not the same as Afghanistan. The bloodlines are not even the same. But we need to know the people with whom we're dealing. And we thought we kind of knew going into Iraq, but we didn't. And we didn't know the...
Do you mean we as a society? Did you think that within the military as well?
Indeed. When 2002, we were all questioning whether, in my line of work, and I was in the Pentagon at the time, I think a lot of us wondered if we really understood the Sunni Shia divide, the various branches, the who's who in the sheikhs. How that all fits together, the way the Ba'athists work with the Ba'athists in maybe Syria and other nations. I think there was a lot of questions, and we thought we'd kind of find our way, and it took a while to get a more encompassing understanding. We're seeing some of that in Afghanistan, but I think we're better prepared. We realize that many times in the Middle East, things are not what they seem. And be very conscious of the second and third order effects of what you're doing in a nation. And although it's what seems very logical to us may be not even within the realm of the feasible to a local, like going to school. You know, don't you want to go to school? Well, probably not.
Rear Admiral Michael T. Franken is my guest. He is Deputy Director of Strategy, Plans, and Policy for United States Central Command. We'll return to our conversation in a moment, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We are talking this hour with Rear Admiral Michael T. Franken, who is Deputy Director of Strategy, Plans, and Policy for the United States Central Command. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Admiral, has our intelligence gathering in places where we are not currently engaged in combat, has it changed based on what we've come to understand about what we didn't know in places like Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, we don't have the what's called human intelligence that we had a few decades ago in much of the world. And I'm not an intelligence officer. I'm a surface warrior. I'm a ship driver. But anecdotally, certainly, we don't have the people on the ground throughout the world like we used to. And when we say people, they're usually involved with the agency or other assessment people. But we do have the ability to listen, and a lot of things are in the open press. So we have, and that alone is a huge intelligence gathering effort to just see what's written in the press. Of course, we share with our allies, our coalition. Just so you know, in the J5 shop, which is the J meaning joint and 5 meaning the plans and policy strategy shop in Central Command, I have 67 different nations represented and 280-some personnel. And so we share information with our coalition people. And they're just not, obviously not just from Central Command. They're from around the world, even Russians. So we have, we do pretty well. And this nation spends a lot for its to know what's going on elsewhere in the world. I've got to say that nobody does it better than we do. And frankly, with the amount of money we spend, that's what you should expect.
How does CENTCOM coordinate its objectives and operations with NATO?
Very good questions, Chris. We have a 4-star command in Afghanistan. You're speaking for Central Command, I would imagine. We have a 4-star command in Afghanistan and a 3-star deputy that has a NATO hat and a U.S. hat. The coordination goes quite well, quite seamlessly, and one of the reasons, because we coming out of Afghanistan, we understand Iraq, we kind of understand how this works now. The rub comes with ROE, rules of engagement, and what each country's permits its soldiers to do. We're not always entirely aligned. They're not all U.S. and they're not all Brits and they're not all. So whenever you have a non-homogeneous force, there are some seams. Good coordination can eliminate those seams, but you need to be conscious of them.
So what you're saying is administratively, you have to know which personnel can be sent from NATO to do a particular job and which ones aren't allowed.
Well, this is also a question better left to those on the ground in Afghanistan. But in naval terms, that's certainly the case. I was previously a CTG 152.0 commander, and I had 24.
Explain what that is.
That is the body of water from Iraq in the north to the Straits of Hormuz in the south. In essence, the Arabian Gulf or the Persian Gulf, as it's known. 24 different ships, 8 different countries, and you need to be aware, privy of what national permissions, authorities exist for specific missions. It's not that much different on the ground.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ron in Carrollton. Hello, Ron.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Hey, my question is that basically we've been at war for over 8 years. That's not a surprise. Public opinion is starting to turn against further involvement. How does the Obama administration, how are they going to go forward in light of changing public sentiment against the war? And then I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Thanks.
Ron, I think if you know the answer to that, you should call the White House. I think they would be quite interested in that. The public opinion, I noticed in the polls as well, is 38% in favor, 50-some percent against. And I don't know how that question was worded either. I didn't see the actual question. That makes a big difference on how those opinion polls are made. The White House needs to, and they're certainly as competent to do this as any White House, to decide if this is in the best interest. And sometimes if public opinion may not be entirely behind the national effort, the national will, that should probably not be the only determining factor. Sometimes public opinion perhaps lags what the national will ought to be from a historical standpoint. So, I mean, they're looking at it more broadly. Things change when you have an economic downturn. People are probably inherently less likely to support a war effort. And although that doesn't diminish the necessity of the war effort. So you have to kind of balance things. And only, but the White House is in a position to kind of look at it more broadly and perhaps balance near-term sentiment with long-term necessity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I would like to have a comment and a question. My comment would be that I'm about as liberal as they come in this part of the world, and I would like it known that I think we need to stay in Afghanistan for as long as it takes to do the job, given that we set an appropriate understanding of what the job is. I'm wondering if we haven't perhaps set our goals too high in Afghanistan. I think maybe expecting us to turn that place into a liberal democracy with a Western economy in 5-10 years is expecting too much. I think perhaps a more realistic approach might be to just be there and kill as many violent fundamentalist Taliban and Al-Qaeda acolytes as possible for as long as it takes to stop that place from becoming an example to the rest of the fundamentalist Middle East as the little engine that could, the little ragtag bunch of rebels that kicked America's rear end. There are so many people that would like to see that story play out over there. And if we do let that story play out, we're going to have a much bigger problem on our hand. So that's my thoughts on that. My question has to do with, given the recent bombing in Mumbai, is there not an opportunity for us to strategically align closer to India than Pakistan, given that Pakistani government is riddled with holes and sympathies for Islamic fundamentalists? And maybe we should be aligning ourselves with India and working on a strategy with them to pacify both India and Pakistan, since pacify both Pakistan and Afghanistan, since India regards Pakistan as just as much of a threat as any other country in the area. And given Pakistan's proclivity for fomenting nuclear weapon technology to the rest of the world, I would have to say that fear is probably justified.
Yeah, and thanks very much for your call. Is it either or, India and or Pakistan?
It's not, although it depends who you ask. If you ask Pakistan leadership, they are very reticent for anything that we support with the Indians. The Indians, frankly, don't need a lot of support. It's a country of 1 billion people. They are well-educated, certainly their leadership. They know where they're going in the world. They know that they live in a rather uncomfortable neighborhood. India, incidentally, is not in our area of responsibility, but certainly neighboring. And as I said earlier, you can't deal with Pakistan without addressing things in Delhi. We are developing a closer relationship with India, and matter of fact, we have exchanged officers visiting. U.S. Pacific Command has India under their cognizance. Our leadership has gone with Pacific Command leadership and visited both India and Pakistan to show that in the U.S., both Pakistan and to India, there is no line of demarcation. You're one and the same in South Asia. And although you need to be addressed separately, the objectives are the same. If you compare the two, and ask yourself, going back to 1972, which country has been more roguish and problematic? If you ask 100 people that, you may not get unanimity in those answers either. Certainly, Pakistan has upset the administration on a few things in the past 5 years in their behavior. We need them desperately for Afghanistan, and we cannot have a nation of 180 million people or so fomenting radical activity that is exported elsewhere. And I don't think the Pakistanis don't want that, certainly not. The Pakistanis I know and have known since early 80s are the most ardent supporter of U.S. efforts in South Asia.
Switching gears here for just a minute, can you explain, I think it might take a lot of people by surprise, that given the area of responsibility that CENTCOM has, that Israel, in fact, is not within that area of responsibility. Can you talk about the reasons for that?
Well, I'm glad to see that you don't pull punches with the easy questions. Israel is part of European command, and the reason we do that is so that we can address the Middle East problems with Israel in the Middle East peace plan without being burdened as having our comments and our support attenuated by our corresponding support of Israel, i.e. we leave that to another combatant commander.
So you don't want to play one side against the other?
Well, not internally to Central Command. We have Admiral Jim Stavridis, who's the European commander. He has Israel in his area of responsibility. So certainly the Middle East peace plan, although the military has a role in that, that is a State Department initiative. Specifically, Senator, it's now under the undertaking of a number of offices, but we do that frequently to kind of divide our attention so that we can be wholly behind an effort in one nation, such as Pakistan and India, and support that nation's ideals with the State Department and with the White House, so that it's not diluted.
In addition to the things that we've talked about today, one of the things that CENTCOM takes care of is piracy problems in that region. Have your folks been taken by surprise at the rate at which this problem seems to have worsened, or are we simply more aware of it now in the general public than we were in the past?
Well, there's actually been a gap here of pirate activities off the coast of Africa, mostly because of Sea State. It's the windy season. We're not surprised by it. Piracy off the coast of Africa started with the fishing industry. When Somalia failed to function as a nation in the early 90s, fishermen from around the world plied their waters and violated their exclusive economic zone and went inside their 12 nautical mile limits, and hence the fishermen in Somali said we can't stand this, and they went out and they hijacked fishing boats, and then that seemed to be a pretty lucrative endeavor, and lacking any kind of law at home, they brought it up to bigger and bigger ships. So this has been going on for 5 years or longer. There, piracy is a long, long effort here, and we can talk a long time. There are no easy answers.
Sadly, we have run out of questions, but that's probably the perfect way to end things. Rear Admiral Michael T. Franken is Deputy Commander of Strategy, Plans, and Policy for United States Central Command. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.